Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on the program, the award-winning book Spires in the Sun, The Carpenter Gothic Episcopal Churches of Florida.
There have been a lot of very creative ways in finding solutions and places for these churches today.
We'll discuss pragmatism, Seminoles, and science in the Everglades.
As transportation made South Florida more accessible, schemes to drain the Everglades proliferated.
And we'll get an update on Wakulla Springs archaeology. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
There's a place dear to me where I'm longing to be with my friends at the old country church.
Spires in the Sun, The Carpenter Gothic Episcopal Churches of Florida by Jonathan Rich, with photographs by Phil Eschbach, earned the 2024 Charlton Thibault Award for an Outstanding General Interest Book from the Florida Historical Society. Carpenter Gothic churches were designed by architect Richard Upjohn for the American frontier of the mid-1800s, and construction of the churches in Florida was encouraged by Bishop John Freeman Young. Author Jonathan Rich.
If historians had to agree on the single person most responsible for bringing the Carpenter Gothic Episcopal style of church to Florida, without hesitation, they would agree that it was John Freeman Young. Now, that's not to say that there weren't others involved. It would be more accurate to say that the style was brought here by an entire wave of clergymen, architects, and laypersons.
Florida's Carpenter Gothic churches are easily identified by their spires, pointed arches, and board and batten siding. Jonathan Rich points out that there was a purpose to this design.
This architecture is very angular, very steep. The roofs are steeply pitched. The windows are pointed either with a classic Gothic arch or with straight pointed tops, straight edged tops. And the purpose, together with the siding itself, the board and batten, which is vertically aligned, is all meant to draw the eye and, it's hoped, the mind heavenward. The idea of the church being, like others, a hand or finger pointing heavenward.
Today, these small, quaint churches are almost always painted white, but that was not the color originally used.
That's a good point, and one that often isn't known. At the time, back in the 1800s, say from 1850 to 1900, when this style was prevalent on the frontier in America, it was thought that it would be best to link these churches made of wood with their stone forebears. And so they were painted brown or gray back then. Also, those colors of paint at that time were cheaper than white. Eventually, a white formula was developed that was itself cheap, and then they were all painted white. Today, they're typically painted white with some other trim color, but back then, they were painted an earthen color, and that was thought appropriate.
There are many fascinating stories in the book Spires in the Sun. One is about the impromptu renaming of a church.
St. Mary's in Daytona was originally named St. Mark's. And when they were ready to build their first church, the cornerstone arrived from far away, where the name of the church had been cut into the stone. And instead of unpacking it, they left it crated, and they took it in a procession up the street with clergy and masons available for a Masonic ceremony at the groundbreaking. And they pried open the crate, and pulled out the stone, and the entire crowd fell silent because instead of saying St. Mark's, they had misconstrued the K as a Y, and it said St. Mary's. So they quickly, they hastily assembled a conference and decided on the spot that rather than ship the stone back and get a new stone, which would take months and to postpone construction, they decided that a divine hand might have been in the stonecutter's transposal, and they renamed St. Mark's St. Mary's on the spot.
The first Carpenter Gothic-style church in Florida was built in Palatka. During the Civil War, the church was occupied by Union troops, and its Bible went missing. Jonathan Rich.
St. Mark's in Palatka was built in 1855. It's the oldest of these Carpenter Gothic Episcopal churches remaining. It was designed personally by Richard Upjohn. When it was built, Florida had only about 100,000 residents in the entire state. It was occupied by Union troops who steamed up in a gunboat from Jacksonville during the Civil War, and they notoriously cooked their meat in the baptismal font, but they also held services in the church. And when they left, they carried off the church's great Bible. And it was assumed from that point that the Bible was lost. But decades later, a man wrote from Connecticut to the parish and said, I've come across this Bible in an attic or wherever he found it. And he said, judging from the flyleaf inscription, it belongs to you, and I'm going to send it to you. So it was restored to St. Mark's years after the Civil War.
St. Paul's Church at Federal Point, north of Palatka, is on the cover of Spires in the Sun. After the church was built, the congregation could not afford to put in stained glass windows, so they came up with an unusual fundraising plan.
They went into the adjacent swamp and collected alligator eggs and then drained them through a pinhole, then painted them with intricate Florida scenes, tied on bows, and then sold them to steamboat tourists for 25 cents an egg and raised all the money for their windows in that manner.
It took 17 years of research to produce the book Spires in the Sun. Complementing Jonathan Rich's text are the photographs of ninth-generation Floridian Phil Eschbach.
We came up with our list, and we started going, spending weekends, since we both were still working, to churches to photograph them. The problem was that we may get to a church, and it was raining, so we couldn't get pictures. We might get some inside, but then we'd have to come back. Or we'd decide, well, you know, it'd be better to come back when the flowers were in bloom. And another situation would be we'd get to a church and the sun was wrong. We got there in the afternoon and it had to be done in the morning. So we'd either have to spend the night or come back another day. And so that was part of the problems of photographing them, is getting good shots. It meant going back several times, sometimes multiple times, to get them right.
Eschbach also used a lot of historic images, some of which required a lot of restoration.
As we went to each church, we would ask them, do you have a picture? Frequently, there would be one on the wall. And so I would copy it. Or sometimes we would email. They would say, oh, I found this one. They'd email it to me, and it would be in terrible shape, scratched or, you know, wrinkled. And so I would go into Photoshop and kind of fix it up to make it look a little better. I wouldn't alter it, but I would just get rid of a scratch or whatever. And so we would do that with the old ones as much as possible.
Spires in the Sun documents which Carpenter Gothic churches have been extensively altered and the many that have been destroyed by fire, storms, and demolition. The book also looks at the churches that still exist and are in use and the problems they face today. Jonathan Rich.
How do they compete, so to speak, in the modern world? How do they meet the needs of a modern parish? And the answers have been various. Some parishes have built later, larger sanctuaries and have used these churches as their chapels. Others have expanded these churches, lengthening the naves or otherwise expanding them, sometimes with side aisles and shed roofs. Others have used them for decades and decades, but then finally given them to museums. An example of that is Beach's Museum Chapel, formerly St. Paul's by the Sea at Jacksonville Beach. Another is San Marco Preservation Hall at Fletcher Park in Jacksonville, which was Old St. Paul's in Arlington or South Arlington. So there have been a lot of very creative ways in finding solutions and places for these churches today.
Spires in the Sun, The Carpenter Gothic Episcopal Churches of Florida by Jonathan Rich with photographs by Phil Eschbach earned the 2024 Charlton DeBow Award for an Outstanding General Interest Book from the Florida Historical Society. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the story of the Everglades and the evolution of cultural and scientific thought on the environment and the people who populated the region has played a significant role in Florida's history and economy. Many of these stories center around the complicated history surrounding efforts to drain the Everglades and the failure to achieve that goal.
Americans embraced a view of progress that included a form of settler colonialism that required the removal of indigenous people to make way for individual farms and market villages that supported the ideology of a democratic republic and an economy based on capitalism. Indigenous people were pushed west or south, in the case of Florida, onto land deemed wasteland, that is, swamps, deserts, and the Great Plains. Although indigenous people had used these lands as part of their strategies of hunting and food gathering and as refuge in times of war, white settlers found no purpose for these so-called wastelands except as reservations for native people. By the second half of the 19th century, however, the technology and engineering expertise that spurred industrialization provided the tools to transform these wastelands and make them productive. The technology also transformed social ideas to create what historians loosely call progressivism, a belief in science to develop efficient systems to address human problems, including draining eastern swamps to create farms that utilize scientific agriculture and making the deserts bloom in the west. As transportation made South Florida more accessible, schemes to drain the Everglades proliferated. After some initial successes in the early 1880s, industrialist Hamilton Diston's dredging, canal building, and development ended in failure. Florida Governor Napoleon Bonaparte Brower used state funds to take up the cause of drainage in the early 20th century. His efforts also fell short. Much of the focus on history has been on these two efforts and the support for the projects by progressives. Chris Willem, one of a Florida cohort of rising environmental historians, wrote his first article for the Florida Historical Quarterly in 2012. On opposition to Everglades drainage from three important progressive: Frank Stoneman, the editor of the Miami Morning News Record, Minnie Moore Wilson, a Seminole activist, and John Kunkel Small, a botanist.
Connie, this is an eclectic group of dissenters. Their background suggests multiple sources of opposition, but seem out of step with the progressive movement generally and the standard dichotomy that places conservationists against preservationists.
Willem says as much early in the article when he notes that, quote, opposition to drainage represented a minority view, as progressive conservationists were generally supportive of the venture. Although conservationists believed exploitation of resources should be limited, efficient, and pragmatic, they justified exploitation as an essential part of American capitalism, end quote. The limitations on exploitation would be determined by experts. Willem builds on David McCauley's work and argues that historians, quote, need to explore the nuance and complexity of the different identities Floridians have assigned to the Everglades throughout history. Opposition to the Everglades drainage has not been explored in detail. A closer look at the three dissenters is a step forward in addressing that gap in understanding. Frank Stoneman played a pivotal role in the early history of the preservation of the Everglades. As editor of the newspaper that would become the Miami Herald, he criticized Everglades drainage as early as 1906 and was a strong advocate for the creation of Everglades National Park. Initially an enthusiastic supporter of Broward's drainage plan, he became a vocal opponent, citing the scheme as unpractical and inefficient, too costly and overly optimistic. Stoneman was not opposed to drainage in principle, but criticized what he viewed as a lack of planning and study. Willem labels these criticisms as, quote, consistent with the values of the progressive era, end quote. Stoneman and Broward agreed, quote, that the Everglades did not need to be preserved or protected, but rather needed to be officially exploited for the benefit of humans. They differed on how to accomplish the goals. Stoneman saw the Everglades as too massive a landscape to be easily altered, end quote. He argued that drainage was a complicated problem that needed further study by scientists, engineers, and other experts. Rather than moving forward with scientific reports and engineering plans, Broward's drainage project relied too much on campaign literature. In an editorial entitled Forethought, Stoneman accused the drainage planners of taking to heart the scriptural injunction, take no thought for the morrow. He argued that Broward's drainage plan, quote, started with no definite knowledge and no definite plans, and the drainage operations have been carried on in a heedless, reckless way that is the astonishment and amusement of the engineering world, end quote. In summary, Stoneman did not oppose drainage on principle, but on the lack of scientific planning and efficiency in the specific Broward project. If carried forward, he believed, corporations rather than individual farmers would be the beneficiaries of drainage. In time, other newspaper editors joined Stoneman's criticism. Minnie Moore Wilson, a Seminole rights activist and conservationist, opposed Everglades drainage for radically different reasons. A member of the General Federation of Women's Clubs and the Friends of Florida Seminoles, Moore Wilson was viewed by one of her contemporaries as, quote, provocative, often abrasive, but always interesting, end quote. Her conflict with May Mann Jennings, wife of Governor William Jennings and long-serving president of the Florida Federation of Women's Clubs, illustrated both their differences on Seminole rights and the role of the Everglades in securing those rights. Jennings supported progressive thought that indigenous people should be assimilated into the American society. Moore Wilson opposed assimilation and advocated for the preservation of traditional culture and Everglades preservation. As Willem notes, quote, she connected the fate of the Seminoles to the fate of the Everglades, end quote. Moore Wilson perceived of the Everglades as endemic and exotic and believed that, quote, drainage would destroy the Seminole land and pave the way for further white settlement and Indian removal, end quote. To Moore Wilson, drainage was simply, quote, a crime against an innocent people that is robbing the Everglade country of success and a triumph, end quote. Instead of draining the Everglades, she argued, government should hold the wetlands, quote, forever for the native people, for wild animal life, and as a winter home for the migratory birds of the North American continent, end quote. Her plea, while heartfelt, ignored the role the Seminoles played in the plume trade. and the connections Seminoles had with the market economy. Moore Wilson, working with the Florida Federation of Women's Clubs, persuaded the state to set aside a 100,000-acre reservation, which the Seminoles traded for the current reservation in Hollywood, Florida. Moore Wilson viewed the 1934 creation of Everglades National Park positively, even as she came to realize that the park would not protect the Seminoles, but exclude them from what she saw as their traditional land. John Kunkel Small saw the Everglades as a biological treasure trove. Small was critical of drainage, but rarely entered the realm of the political debates on the future of the Everglades. His contributions were scientific as the advisor to Royal Palm State Park, the author of 450 articles and books, and the collector of 60,000 specimens for the New York Botanical Garden. Small's scientific writings and his book, From Eden to Sahara, played a role in Ernest Coe's efforts to obtain federal designation of an Everglades National Park. As Willem explains, Small, quote, neither saw the Everglades as a resource that needed to be exploited efficiently, nor as a refuge for Native Americans, but instead viewed the region as a unique biological landscape and scientific resource that needed to be studied, cataloged, and analyzed, a natural history museum that should be protected for its scientific educational value, end quote. By 1929, he was in agreement with those who had advocated for a national park.
Interesting as always. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. There are exciting archaeological discoveries being made at Wakulla Springs. Sebastian Garcia has this update.
James S. Dunbar is an archaeologist and chair of the Acela Research Institute. I spoke with James about Wakulla Springs and his archaeological research over several years on the site. His involvement with Wakulla Springs was personal, as a state archaeologist who first studied the site during the 1990s anointed James to continue researching Wakulla Springs once he passed.
I happened to know Calvin Jones, who was the state archaeologist at the time working at Wakulla in 1995, and the artifacts that he found there got my interest. And when Calvin passed, he must have said something to the park manager and said I would be a good one to come back. And I never thought it would happen, but in 2008, got a National Geographic grant and started one season of research and then came back in 2017 and 2018 to do the most exploration we've done in a far more controlled way than we had done in 2008.
Wakulla Springs is approximately 14 miles south of Tallahassee and roughly 5 miles east of Crawfordville in Wakulla County, Florida. It is a massive artesian spring that flows and connects with the St. Marks River, and by extension, the sea. Indeed, Wakulla Springs is one of the world's largest and deepest freshwater springs. Aside from its unique environmental features, Wakulla Springs attracted James partly because he suspected the site would be conducive to finding the first Americans.
I've always been interested in the Paleo-Indian time frame, and the more we know about it, the more we know that people lived there from, I'd say right now, at least 13,500 years before present, all the way up to today. And it's a big area of research, if you ask me, but the search for the first Americans, or the early ones at least, and how they lived. And we know that by the end of the last ice age, at about 11,400 years ago, there was a drastic change, at least in Florida, in the toolkit they had. They went from, say, a lancelet type of projectile point to a notched form of projectile point. And it's at that time we don't see most of the large Pleistocene animals on the landscape anymore. And one could speculate that that's one of the reasons that happened. No more herds of horses. White-tailed deer are a little bit more elusive, and those type of things.
Yet, the archaeological findings from James' research at Wakulla Springs were not exclusively limited to the Paleo-Indian time frame. In one excavation, James and his team exhumed artifacts from World War II, indicating that Wakulla Springs was one of many areas in Florida where soldiers trained for the war. Indeed, the discovery augments the site's historical significance.
When we were doing one of our digs, we found an old stump mold that we knew that was disturbed ground and got down in the ground a bit. We found a broken whiskey bottle and a Winston, I think it was Green Pack, which is World War II. There were a lot of GIs that would do R&R there, but they also had that very high diving tower at the time, and they would have these guys jump off and throw kerosene or whatever flammable liquid in the water to say, okay, if you're on a ship, it gets torpedoed and the water is on fire, here's how they showed them how to survive that. The big one was Camp Gordon Johnson, but they did practice some underwater demolition there and a few other things.
James' archaeological research at Wakulla Springs has been completed. In addition to unearthing World War II artifacts, his archaeological team discovered the Simpson Point, a Paleo-Indian projectile point with a characteristic Y blade that aids archaeologists in understanding the myriad of stone tools used by cultural groups during and beyond that time frame. These findings further prove that Wakulla Springs is perhaps one of the few areas in which humans have existed since at least 13,000 years ago.
One of the things that we did, which is find the Simpson Point level, actually excavate. This guy named Tom Harmon was in the pit at the time, but we excavated the first Simpson Point that had ever been excavated in context. We found the PT anomaly with the platinum anomaly, and we knew that anything below that would be pre-Clovis, and 10 centimeters below the PT anomaly was the Simpson Point. And Andy Hemmings, who's one of our archaeologists, did the underwater excavation and didn't get a lot done, but looked at a mastodon. We call it the Vickery Mastodon site. It's underwater. And we think it is somewhere between 13,200 and 13,500 years old. And my tendency is to believe it's on the older side because that's the level the bones rested on. But he just got down there and just did make some recoveries, and the project was over. There's a lot of prehistory there, and there's a lot of history there. And our team included a historic archaeologist, an underwater archaeologist, myself, and we sort of had a full team.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Find us anytime at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.